Good morning. We have a wonderful speaker for you this morning. Professor Joshua Waller is from the College of Forest Resources. He received his master's degree and his PhD in ecology from Utah State University, and he's been a postdoc fellow with the University of Maine, also Oregon State University. He's also worked in the National Research Council and Environmental Protection Agency. His work looks at landscape ecology and conservation biology, especially how human factors and the things that we do influence species distribution and population dynamics. And his talk today is really fascinating. He's going to look at the effects of climate change on amphibians. But let's welcome Professor Joshua Waller.
Okay, thank you, Ann. Right, so I'm going to talk specifically a bit about climate change, quite a bit about climate change, and then I'll talk more specifically about climate change in amphibians and some analyses I've done with some collaborators to look at how, in particular, how climate change might affect amphibians at large spatial scale. Before I start, I want to mention some of those collaborators. Almost the first half of the talk, everything I talk about is going to, well, most of the work I'm going to talk about has been done by the IPCC. But the second half of the talk, when I get into the amphibian, that work's been done as a collaboration. Can I turn on? Okay. So some of my collaborators on this project are Betsy Bancroft, who's here in the College of Forest Resources, Andy Glaustein, who's a herpetologist at Oregon State University, Peter Kariba, who's with the Nature Conservancy, Ed Maurer, who's at Santa Clara University, Sarah Schaefer, who's with the USGS, and Dennis White, who's with the EPA. Okay, so I'm going to start off, as I said, by talking a bit about climate change in general. I'm going to review some of the work that's come out of the latest IPCC reports, give you an idea of what's happening climate-wise. Then I'm going to talk about some of the physical effects of climate change, how climate change is affecting the Earth's physical system. Then I'm going to talk about some of the ecological overview of some of the ecological effects of climate change. And finally, I'm going to get to analysis for amphibians, a vulnerability assessment for amphibians in North and South America. So we'll start with a little review climate change, some of the research that's been done recently, very recently, in terms of how the climate is changing. Well, you all know that the climate is changing most recently due to the greenhouse gases that we've been emitting. And so those greenhouse gases, three of the top greenhouse gases are methane and carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide. And what you see here is a map or sort of trace of those concentrations of those three gases in the atmosphere over time from year zero to roughly year 2000. And these are the concentrations of those gases. And what you see is they've been relatively constant over the last 2,000 years and have undergone dramatic changes in the recent last 50 years or so. And you may have heard arguments that, well, these types of changes, dramatic changes, increases, decreases in these gases have happened in the Earth's history, and that we've seen them before, it's really no big deal. Well, they have happened before, but they haven't happened in a long time. So these trends here now go back about 600,000 years. So this is a much longer time series. And these are, again, trends of these gases over time. And you can see that sharp increase brings them above levels that we've seen in the last 600,000 years. And obviously, we haven't been around measuring the gases for that long. This recent time period wherein we've been able to measure those directly in the atmosphere. But the way we've gotten these measurements, these are from ice cores. And so the glaciologists and the climatologists, they'll drill cores down into the ice, into the ice caps and into glaciers, and they'll go down very, very far, and they'll take out these long, narrow tubes of ice. They have special bits that do this drill through ice. And they bring out these long, narrow cores, and they extract air from the bubbles that are trapped in that ice. And from that air, they can discern the concentrations of these different gases. And so we then know that over the last 600,000 years, we haven't seen concentrations of these greenhouse gases that are this high. These gray periods here where you see higher peaks in some of the greenhouse gases, those are the interglacial warm periods. And so you notice that we're in one now, which is good, because if we weren't, we'd be potentially covered with ice. But it's bad in the fact that we're starting from an already high point, an concentration of CO2 and other greenhouse gases, and we're going up from there. But we know that these greenhouse gases, they're linked to changes in temperature. They're linked to the temperatures that we see on the surface of the Earth. This is a trend in measured temperatures over the last 150 years or so. And you can see that there's this, each one of the black dots is a global average temperature for a given year. The blue line and the gray, that's a smooth trend. But you just need to look at these actual colored lines that show you the trend through those data. So we see that there's an increasing trend, that red line, across that 150 year or so period. As we get closer and closer to the present, as you look at more and more recent time periods, you can see that those trends increase. They get steeper. So we're seeing more and more warming recently, to the point that in the last 12 years, 11 of the last 12 years have been the hottest years on record. So we know it's getting warmer, and it's getting warmer more quickly towards as closer you get to today. If we look at the patterns of that warming across the Earth, so this is trends in temperature change over the last 100 years across the planet. These are measured from weather stations. We see that the areas that are redder, orange, yellow, those are areas that have been getting warmer. The areas that are blue, it's hard to tell the blue from the gray, I'll point them out. Areas that are getting blue have been getting cooler over that 100-year period. There are only a few of them. There's some right here, and there are a couple down here. The other spots in there are gray. There are grayer areas where we don't have data for that period. What you can see is most of the planet has been getting warmer. Some areas have been getting warmer than others. The pluses are where the trends have been significant. If we look at a shorter period, more recent period, and as we saw with that, the plot of the annual data with those colored lines going, but we know that the trends are stronger as you get closer to the present. We see that the trends are indeed stronger when we just look at the last 30 years, last 25 years. We can see that more warming has occurred towards in the northern latitudes, and that's partly because there's more land mass in the north, and the land heats up more than the oceans. The oceans are absorbing some of that heat and have a cooling effect. That also leads to the fact that the centers of the continents are warmer than the edges in general. So we see more warming towards the center of the continents, and we see more warming over the land than we do over the ocean. Again, these are data, these are measured data, these are measurements we have, they're not predictions. If we look a little higher up, this is the troposphere, this is the lowest level of the atmosphere, you can see that the patterns are similar. Everywhere has pretty much been getting warmer, but there's less distinct patterns of the effects of the continents, so that as soon as you get up off the ground a little bit, the water has less of an effect on the surface drawn temperature. But what about precipitation? These are maps of precipitation trends in the last 100 years and then in the last 25 years or so. What we see is there's a lot more variability in precipitation. We don't see that same dramatic effect of everywhere changing in the same way. We see that some places that are greener here have been getting wetter over the last 100 years. Some places that are sort of yellower, redder, right in here, for example, have been getting drier. If you look at the last 30 years, you see a different picture. Some of those same areas that were getting wetter look like they're getting drier just in the last 30 years. And the patterns are not necessarily the same around the world. There's also a lot more areas where we have less data, and there are a lot of areas that are white here, which means there was no significant trend in one direction or the other. So precipitation, the patterns in the recent past have been much more variable. It's not changing in one direction like temperature. So let's talk now a little. So those are data we know. That's historic data. There's plenty of certainty in those data. We know those things are happening. Now let's talk a little bit about how things might happen in the future. If we were to look out using climatic projections, using models to project what's happening, potentially going to happen in the future. So the climate scientists that model the Earth's climate, they use fairly large, complex models to do that. These models have several layers in the atmosphere. They divide the atmosphere into several different layers, many layers, and they divide the oceans into many different layers. And those layers are broken into little cells there are a couple of degrees of longitude and latitude of peace. And in these little cells, they've got all these processes going on that manipulate carbon dioxide, methane, the different greenhouse gases. They move around moisture and air currents and temperature, and they move those things between cells, and all the cells talk to each other, and things move around. And those models run for months, and they run for months and months on supercomputers. So it takes a lot of computing power to run one of these things. There are at least 14 of these models being run in different labs around the world. And each one of these models is built a little differently. The climate scientists have a little different way of describing how the Earth's systems work. And so each of these models produces a slightly different prediction, sometimes more than slightly different. But you get different outputs of these different models because they're built in different ways. So we've got lots of big models predicting lots of different future climates. There's another reason that these models predict different future climates, so that we can get different predicted future climates. And that's because we don't know exactly how much CO2, how much methane, how much of those different greenhouse gases we're going to put in the atmosphere in the next 100 years. There's some uncertainty about that. We could be really good and cut way back, stop driving cars, come up with new fuels, and we could be very efficient. If we stopped all of our greenhouse gas emissions, we might follow this trajectory. If we did that in the year 2000. Well, we didn't, so we're not going to follow that trajectory. But we could look at that potential scenario. We could look at other scenarios where we consume more fossil fuels. There's one scenario that the IPCC got together and came up with a whole bunch of different scenarios that they could use to look at how the climate might change, different carbon dioxide, greenhouse gas emission scenarios. They gave them these really cool names, like the B1 and the B2 and the A2. They do mean things. They have whole little stories that go with these little letters and numbers. For instance, the A1B was originally thought of as sort of a business as usual scenario, such that if we kept going at the rate we're going now, using greenhouse gas, producing greenhouse gases, we'd follow that trajectory. And that trajectory is that green one right in here. There was a little more intensive, a less intensive scenario. The B1 is one that the IPCC concentrated on. Well, that's one if we're fairly good and we start to reduce our emissions. And then there's the A2, which was originally thought of as a fairly extreme scenario, where if we just cranked up, had more population growth, used more fossil fuels, we'd follow that track. Well, there's another track that they didn't concentrate as much on. There's a couple higher scenarios. They're called the fossil fuel intensive scenarios, the A1FI scenarios. Those are over here. But they're not over here because the IPCC didn't have those climate scientists model them in the same comprehensive way that they modeled the other ones, because they thought they were probably a little too extreme. Well, unfortunately, we're now somewhere closer to that A1FI track because we haven't done the cutting back it would take to keep us on some of the other ones. So there are these different tracks, and there's variability in each of these projections, that light-colored fuzz around those lines. And that's from the fact that there are several models, 14 potentially of these models projecting the climate for each of these different scenarios. So let's talk about what some of those scenarios predict, what some of the predicted outcomes of the climate projections are. These are projected temperatures in degrees Celsius for the globe for two different time periods, 2020 through 2029, so roughly 30 years from today, 20 years from today, and roughly the end of the century. And this is with the A2 scenario. So this is the more extreme of the three that the IPCC was looking at. Maybe the track that we're a little closer to being on that scenario. And if we look at 20 years from today or so, we see temperatures across the northern part of the world, the northern hemisphere, they're between 1 and maybe 2 degrees Celsius higher. If we look at the end of the century, we see across North America, we see temperatures that are more between 3.5 and maybe 5.5 degrees higher. And these are degrees Celsius, so to get Fahrenheit, which is what we're used to, you have to multiply by 1.8, which gives you quite a bit higher temperatures, the types of measurements that we're used to. We notice a couple things about these maps. One is that there's more warming in the northern hemisphere, where there's larger land masses. There's more warming over the land than there is over the water. And there's more warming towards the center of the continents than there is to the edges of the continents. And that's the same thing we saw in the historic data, in the data we've measured, right? So we're seeing the same trends. The models are able to actually pick that up and reproduce that. That gives us a little bit of confidence in what these models are predicting. These are predictions of changes in precipitation. This is for the end of the century, and the map on the left is our winter, December, January, February. The map on the right is our summer, June, July, and August. The areas that are blue or bluish-greenish, those are areas where there's projected to be increases in precipitation for that time period. The areas that are reddish-yellowish, those are areas that are projected to get drier, where there's projected to be decreases in precipitation. The little dots indicate areas where there's 90% agreement across the different GCM models, or the GCMs, the general circulation models. The GCMs, I'll use that term again and again, GCMs are those big models that the climate scientists use to model the Earth's climate. So what you see here is that unlike temperature, and more like the projection or the historic trend in precipitation, we see that things are different in different parts of the world. We see projected increases in precipitation towards the northern, high northern latitudes. We see decreases in sort of a couple belts here. But the patterns are different. They're different in different places, and they're different in different seasons. So take a look at the Pacific Northwest up here, which is predicted to get a little more precipitation in the summer, and more precipitation in the winter, and less precipitation in the summer. Kind of the opposite of what we might like. But you see that things are different across seasons. Things are different in different parts of the world in terms of precipitation. So again, there's less reliability in the precipitation projections. There are lots of areas that are white, where there is no significant trend, or there was no trend one direction or the other in which way the precipitation would go. So less certainty in precipitation. Again, that kind of matches what we know from our historic records as well. Precipitation is less predictable, it's less regular across the globe. So how do these models do at actually predicting historic climate? Because you can run them backwards. You can run forwards and you can run them backwards. You can project the future, you can project the past, right? So they've done that, of course. The climate scientists have run their models for historic periods. And here we've got 1900 through 2000. The black line are the measured annual temperature trends. So black line's the temperature from our records. The yellow lines, all those yellow squiggles, are projections from 14 different general circulation models, GCMs. I think it's 58 different runs, or 54 different runs of 14 models. So there's lots of projections in all that yellow spaghetti. And then this red line is sort of the average, is the average of those yellow lines, of those projections. And so what you see is that there's a fairly good correlation. The red line matches that black line. So the models are doing a pretty good job of capturing at least temperature over that time period. There are some lines here with some words. Anybody know what these things are? Yeah, those are volcanoes. And we know that when a volcano erupts, if it's big enough, this volcano is going to put solids, particulates, into the atmosphere. And what those do is they act as a shade. They block the sun, reflect the sun, and the Earth cools. Particularly if it's a very big volcano, you get some cooling. And so what you see is when these volcanoes erupted, you see the black lines dip. So the actual temperatures of the Earth drop when we have large volcanic eruptions. The models pick that up too. I mean, you have to put the volcanoes in the models, but the models are able to capture those effects and show that the Earth cools when volcanoes erupt. That's good that they can capture that. But one of the good pieces of evidence that we're actually causing some of this warming that's going on comes from sort of the test of the models. So this is a run where these are several runs. Now the model runs are blue here instead of being yellow. This is a test where the climate scientists pulled the human forcings, or the effect of humans putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, out of the model scenario. So they took that out and just let the models run on what the Earth's natural systems are doing without us adding those extra those extra molecules into the atmosphere. Now what happens is the models can't capture that increasing warming trend. They can't do it without those human forces. They've tried other things. They can't find anything else that they can put in there that will actually account for the warming we've seen. So there's pretty good evidence that we need to have that the human element, the greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere, are what is causing this warming towards the end of the century. So let's talk a little bit about some of the physical effects of climate change before we get to the ecological effect. I'm going to read this one quote. This is a quote from a past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the premier science organization in the United States. We're not talking anymore about what climate models might happen in the future. We are experiencing dangerous human disruption of the global climate, and we're going to experience more. So there's pretty clear evidence now. Scientists are in broad agreement that we're changing the atmosphere, and it's likely to have profound effects on the Earth systems. And what is it likely to change? Well, it's likely to change hydrological regimes. It's likely to change weather patterns. It's likely to change flooding events, the frequency of extreme precipitation events, floods. Wildfires, likely to change the prevalence of fires. Things get drier and hotter, we're likely to see changes in fire regimes. Oops, and it is changing sea level. So I'm going to step through, give you some examples of those different things. First example, you've probably seen many pictures like this. There are now collections on the web and other places of pictures of glaciers. Glaciers 50 years ago, glaciers 100 years ago, glaciers today. And the pictures are pretty dramatic, and they show that the glaciers, on the whole, as you might expect, given temperatures going up, are receding, are getting smaller. There's one study said that 110 glaciers have disappeared from Glacier National Park in the last 150 years, and the remaining 37 glaciers are estimated to be gone by 2050. We'll probably need a new name for Glacier National Park. This is some work that was done by the Climate Impact Group, Phil Moat, here on campus. And these are observed trends in snowpack in the western U.S. Over the last roughly 50 years. And the red circles here, I think you guys can see the difference between the red and the blue. The red circles here are areas where the snowpack has been decreasing. The larger the circle, the larger the decrease. And this is spring snowpack. The blue circles are areas where the snowpack has been increasing. What we see is generally a decrease in snowpack in the western U.S., and that kind of makes sense, because if you forget about precipitation for a while and you just think about temperature, as it gets warmer, snow line is going to go up. It's going to go up the sides of the mountains, right? And the snow is going to melt off earlier in the spring. So what that means is we're going to have less snow. When we have less snow at high elevations, a lot of those streams that are fed with that high elevation snow, the regimes, the hydrological regimes of those streams are going to change. We're going to get pulses of water at different times of the year. We're going to get different amounts during the summer, for example. So changes in snowpack are important, and they can be driven. They can be driven by temperature increases. We also know that there are changes in fire regimes. We've already seen changes. You may have noticed that in the last 3, 4, 5 years, you've read a lot more about fires. You've seen a lot more about Western fires in the news. You've read more in the newspaper. You've seen more about these fires. These fires are getting bigger, and they're getting more frequent. And the places they're getting, this was a study that looked at where those fires are getting bigger and more frequent, and where the climate has been changing, where the conditions have been changing. They found that areas, the reddest areas in here, are those where the fuels have been getting drier, the conditions have been getting drier. Those areas correspond pretty well with areas where the fires have been getting bigger and the fires have been getting more frequent. So we're likely to see, as things get warmer, we're likely to see even more frequent and larger fires in the West. Sea level rise is something we can also measure. We know it's been changing. It's been changing over the last 50 years. Sea levels have been rising. But it's a little more complicated than that, because as the water goes up, and the water rises for a number of different reasons, mostly, at this point, thermal expansion. So as water gets hotter, it expands. As anything gets hotter, it expands, right? But there's something else going on at the same time. As different parts of the coast are uplifting or they're subsiding. So in order to figure out what's going on in any one particular place, you have to look at what's happening to the land and what's happening to the ocean. And so parts of Puget Sound, the southern parts of Puget Sound in particular, around Tacoma, those areas are sinking. The land is sinking. So as the sea level goes up and the land sinks, we'll see more sea level rise there than we will in northern parts of Puget Sound where the land, some of it, is uplifted. So we get a reduced effect of sea level rise. So it really depends on where you are as to how much sea level rise is going to be apparent at that particular place on the globe. The IPCC made a fairly conservative estimate of how much sea level is likely to rise because the scientists couldn't get together and agree on how much the melting ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet, the polar ice sheets, how much that would affect sea level rise. The ice that's already in the water, that's floating in the water, when that melts, that doesn't have an effect, a big effect on sea level. But it's the ice on the land, when the glaciers flow into the water, when the ice melts off the land, that can potentially have a big effect. These calculations, 0.2 to 0.6 meters by 2100, don't take into account the potential of those things happening. And we know that they are melting. We don't know the exact rates. We don't know how much it's accounts for the change. We don't know how much those ice sheets, the potential for those ice sheets to break up and allow more ice to go into the water. So we're still not sure of how much should happen. But Jonathan Overpeck, who gave a talk on campus not too long ago, has done some work to look at what has happened in the past in terms of sea level rise. And in the Pliocene, which is now millions of years ago, not the recent past, but in time, it's a time when we have seen changes in greenhouse gases, we've seen higher levels. So in the Pliocene, we had levels, greenhouse gas levels of 400 parts per million. And if you remember some of those charts I showed, that's not too far off from where we are today. We had temperatures that were 3 to 4 degrees higher than what we have today. And again, that's within our projected potential changes for the next 100 years. Well, those temperatures and those CO2 levels were held for a long time. They weren't, you know, just happening over 100 years. They were held for a long time period. But at that time, the sea levels were much higher. They were 15 to 25 meters higher, or potentially even higher than that. What that means is if these temperatures, if we raise them high enough and we hold them long enough, we will see dramatic changes in sea level. Maybe not in the next 100 years, maybe not in the next 200 years. But there's the potential for having much higher sea levels given those even small, what seem like small increases in temperature. So those changes in sea level, if you think of the more dramatic ones, they're possible. A number of researchers have looked at what things might look like if sea level rises certain amounts. So this is some work coming out of the University of Delaware, and the red areas are the areas that might go underwater given 0.61 meters of sea level rise. So that's sort of the high end of what the IPCC was projecting. If we look over here, this is some of Jonathan Overpeck's work, and this is areas in Florida projected to go underwater with a 5-meter sea level rise. And if you think of amphibians, you think of animals in general, when this happens, yeah, the animals are going to need to move, but the people are going to need to move too. And when the people move, they're going to move inland, and they're going to displace a lot of the biodiversity, a lot of the animals that are there. So when I start talking about amphibians, keep that in mind. Okay, some of the ecological effects of climate change. All those changes to the Earth systems are going to have ramifications for plants and animals. We've already seen effects on amphibians, some effects that are as strong as extinctions of entire species. We know that there are changes in phenology, that's the timing of ecological events. Spring events are coming earlier, for example. We know that species are moving around, they're shifting their ranges. We're seeing new species in places we haven't seen them before. That means we're going to get new invasive species or exotic species or species that we could call invasive exotic because we haven't seen them before. So species are moving, things are changing in terms of the time of these events. In terms of earlier spring events, we're seeing a study done by Camille Parmesan summarized all sorts of ecological studies and found that, in general, spring events are coming about 2.3 days earlier per decade. And again, that's over the last 30, 50 years or so. As we get close to the present, as we look at more rapidly changing temperatures, those rates may increase. And in terms of earlier spring events, I'm talking about things like when birds nest, when insects hatch out, when leaves bloom out on trees, when amphibians breed, those things are the things that we're noticing are happening earlier. We're noticing that species are moving, they're shifting their ranges. So this is examples of two European butterfly species, and the maps on the bottom are the southern ends of their range, the maps on the top are the northern ends of their range. And so we've noticed, at least with these two species, contractions in the southern end of the range. These red dots, these red areas, are where they've disappeared from portions of their range in the south, and these green areas are where they've expanded into portions, new parts, new ranges to the north. We've seen this with birds, we've seen it with some mammals, and we've seen it with butterflies and even some other animals and plants. We know that their ranges are shifting. We know their ranges have shifted in the past. As the glaciers have receded, species have moved back and forth across continents. That seems to be what they're doing today as well. We know that some of the species at the highest elevations are likely to be highly impacted by climate change. As species move, they move upslope, there's only so far they can go. So species that are already alpine species, species that are already at high elevations are likely to be some of the heaviest impacted. I'm going to skip this story. This is a story to talk about the complexity of how ecological systems will respond to climate change. This story that involves the whitebark pine, the mountain pine beetle, the grizzly bear, denning times. It's a very complex story, and it's to say that it's not just that species are going to be moving upslope. They're going to be moving poleward, but there are going to be interactions between species and their food resources, species and humans, that will change as climate changes. Okay, we're getting to the frogs. I promise we're getting to the amphibians. This study is one that indicated that, particularly for amphibians, but for lots of species, the ecological changes are going to be more complex. And Alan Pounds noted that there's a particular fungus that infects amphibians all over the world now, but he studies them in Central America. And as climate has been changing, this fungus has been moving around. So populations of frogs that were never exposed to this fungus before are now being exposed to it. And he thinks that many of these populations have gone extinct, and several species are going extinct because they're now exposed to this new disease. And the disease is moving in response to climate change. Okay, so that brings us to amphibians. Amphibians are likely to be highly susceptible to climate change, some of the most susceptible of all the animals. They're likely to be susceptible for many reasons. We already have evidence that they're susceptible. This is one species, the golden toad, that has gone extinct, I would believe, largely due to the effects of climate change. It's a toad that used to live in the rainforests or the cloud forests of Costa Rica. And the conditions changed such that the frog wasn't able to live anymore. But we know that there are lots of reasons that amphibians are likely to be susceptible to climate change. First of all, physiologically, they need moist areas. They need moist, some of them need cool areas. So they're fairly susceptible to changes in precipitation, to changes in moisture. Second, we know that they often use habitats that are fairly susceptible to climate change. Shallow wetlands, perennial streams, temporary wetlands, vernal pools that dry out during the summer. These are all habitats, these are all systems that are likely to be sensitive to changes in temperature, changes in precipitation. More evaporation, less water means that these systems change. Some amphibians will or will not be able to use them to different degrees. Diseases. I mentioned the fungus, the chytrid fungus. Amphibians are susceptible to a number of different diseases, diseases that have been shown to be potentially contributing to the global decline in amphibians we're already seeing. And then finally, amphibians don't move as quickly as a lot of other organisms. Birds, a lot of the bigger mammals, they can move around in response to climate change. It gets warmer, they can move. Amphibians don't move so very fast, right? Particularly the salamanders, fairly slow creatures. So the question we ask in the research I'm going to show you is, how will amphibians in the Western Hemisphere respond to climate change? And what we did is we went about creating a vulnerability assessment, looking at how vulnerable amphibians would be given several different factors. We did that first by doing what I'm going to call bioclimatic modeling, then by mapping the range of restricted range species, and then by a simple climatic assessment. So I'll talk first about bioclimatic modeling, but I'll just talk about these as I get to them. human suspense. So bioclimatic modeling, some people have called it climate envelope modeling, involves taking the current range of a species, where the species is now, relating that to current climate, and then using projected future climate to project the future range of the species. So we build a model using the current distribution of a species, using current climate data. It's a simple correlative predictive model. Then into that model, we take the projections from the general circulation models, and we project where the climatic space for that species should be in the future. Where is the climate envelope that that species can live in? Where is that in the map, on the map of the future climate? You can do that in a number of different ways. We can use statistical models, machine learning-based models. Basically, there are lots of different ways we can do. Lots of different things we can use to build these models. They all have some limitations. First of all, these are correlative models. They're not mechanistic models, so there are a lot of things they don't take into account. They don't take into account dispersal abilities, they don't take into account interspecific interactions, and they don't take into account adaptation. So a species its range may shift, but what if there's something in that new place that its range shifts to that eats it? Well, then it might not actually go there, right? If there's something it competes with and can outcompete, it may not actually go there. In terms of dispersal, well, the range is shifted, but can the salamander actually crawl the 2,000 kilometers in the 70-year period to get there? Well, maybe it can't, right? And finally, adaptation. There's evidence that some species may actually be able to adapt to a certain amount of climate change. Some will likely be able to stay where they are. So the type of modeling, I won't talk too much about it, but we used a type of modeling called random forest classifier. It's a model averaging approach. It doesn't really have anything to do with forests, except that it uses lots and lots of classification and regression trees, which is a modeling approach that happens to be named a tree because of the little form that the models take. It's a model averaging approach because you build lots and lots and lots of models to predict one thing. Predict the distribution of the species. And then you average the prediction of all those models. And it ends up giving you a fairly powerful, fairly accurate prediction of the current distribution of the species. So we use those and built that type of model for each of the amphibians that we were studying. We built models for 1,600 amphibians, all the amphibians in the Western Hemisphere. And we built them using range maps. So these are the kind of maps you'd find in a field guide. If you're looking through a field guide, birds, amphibians, and you wanted to see those blobs of color where the species are on the planet or where they are in the hemisphere. So we built the models using those data. And we took those range maps and we gridded them with a 50 by 50 kilometer resolution. So we had 15,000 grid cells in the Western Hemisphere with a presence or absence for each of the 16,000 amphibians. We use that in conjunction with climate data, 37 different what we're calling bioclimatic variables. These are things all based on temperature and precipitation, but they have a little more to do with biology. Things like dew point, things like growing degree days, potential evapotranspiration. These are the variables that went into those models that predicted the current range of the species. So we built models for 1,600 species. We then picked only the models that could do a really good job of predicting today's range. We didn't want a lot of error in these models. And that gave us about 413 models for 413 amphibians. So the results I'm going to talk about were done, at least these projections of climatic range shifts, were done for 413 amphibians. Into those models, we put 20 different projections of the Earth's climate. So these come from 10 different general circulation models, 10 of those big models of the Earth's climate, run for two different emission scenarios. And you'll recognize the names of those. We use the lower one, the B1, and the higher one, the A2. And this is what those range projections look like. So this is a potential range shift for a poison dart frog. And you can see that this light green area here is where the model predicted the range would be stable, where the species is today and it would potentially be in the future. This is for about 100 years from today. The darker green area is where the model predicted a range expansion, so where the species is not today but projected to potentially be able to live in the future. And then the pink is an area where the model predicted a range contraction, where the species is today but the model predicts it won't be able to live in the future because the climatic conditions will change so much that it won't be able to live there. So we see a fairly dramatic range contraction and a fairly sizable potential range expansion. This is the same kind of map, a range projection for the leopard frog. And you see this one shows a large range contraction to the southern portion of the range, in the southern portion of the range, and a fairly sizable range expansion at the northern end of the range. This is the kind of poleward shift in species that we've been seeing. It's the kind of thing we expect to see. These letters and numbers up here, this indicates that this is just one of the 20 maps that we built for this species. So this is one for one general circulation model and the lower B1 emission scenario. So for each of the 400 or so amphibian species, we made 20 different maps like this. So we had 20 maps for each of 400 species. That's about 8,000 maps. We took those 8,000 maps and we summarized them. And we got measures of how much any particular place in the Western Hemisphere would be likely to change in terms of the amphibians there. Now, there's a bunch of gray area in here where we didn't have very many amphibians in our data set, so we didn't do this calculation here. What we calculated is the number of times there was one of those red areas, those range contractions, the number of times there was a range expansion in a given cell. So how many species were going to expand into that cell potentially, how many species were going to contract from that cell potentially. Then we divide by the total number of species there today. So it's a percent change potentially, a percent change in the fauna, the amphibians that are at that site. And it's not extinctions, it's not a loss of any species, but it's change in any one 50 by 50 kilometer cell. So the amphibians that are there could move right next door. But the point is that if you went to that one place in space, there'd be that much difference in the amphibian community. And so these summarize the 10 different projections for the 400 species for the B1 and the 10 projections for the A2. And you see that if we just look across much of South America here, we're seeing that 80% of the climate change projections result in a 50 to 60% change in the amphibian fauna. That's a fairly sizable turnover in the species that are in any one given place. So you can see that some areas are projected to see more change than others, particularly Central America, and down along the Andes are projected to see lots of change. Some up in North America were projected to see more change up in these areas where ranges are likely to be expanded. We then took these projections and we summarized them using ecoregions. And we did that so that we could compare them to some of the other aspects of this vulnerability assessment that I'm going to talk about. So these are ecoregions sort of averaged. These are these numbers averaged across different ecoregions in North and South America. And so you see that the highest projected turnover rates or change rates were many of them were in the Andes, some of them were higher at the higher northern latitudes, and lots in Central America, pardon me. So what about movement limitations? We're still talking about these range shifts now, but what about movement limitations? What if they can't move into those new ranges fully? What if they can only move 50 kilometers, 100 kilometers, 200 kilometers into those new ranges? So we investigated how much their ranges might change overall if we did that, if we restricted their movement into those new ranges. This is the percentage of species projected to experience different percentages of range loss. So here's greater than 0% range loss. So that's an overall decrease in range size. When we've got full dispersal, when they're allowed to move completely into that new range, about 87% are projected to see some loss. That means only 13% are likely to see to be stable or gain overall in the range size. But if we look all the way up to, if we limit them to only 50 kilometers, about 97% of the species are projected to see some loss. We also look at how many are going to see lots of loss, up to 90% loss in the area of their current range. And that ranges from maybe 38% if they're allowed to move fully into the new range, up to 42-43% if they're restricted to 50 kilometers from their new range. Now, one thing you notice is there's really not that much difference between the yellow bars and the green bars. So that even if they are able to fully disperse into these new ranges, they're not likely to do very well. They're still likely to see fairly large range contractions. I'm going to skip through this agriculture stuff. We'll get to the next part of the vulnerability assessment has to do with where the restricted range species are. Well, we modeled 400, or I showed you results for 400 out of 1,600 species, right? So that means we didn't model about 3/4 of the species. We didn't use them in those analyses. So 3/4 of the amphibians in the Western Hemisphere weren't included in that turnover assessment. Which species were those? Well, on the whole, they were species with really small ranges, species that it was hard to model. So we decided to look and see where those species are, because it's species with really small ranges that are likely to be highly susceptible to climate change. They've got fairly specific habitat requirements. They don't have much room to play with to begin with. So we looked at where those are. Those circles are around where some of those species are with restricted ranges. And here's where they are. This is the number of species with fairly small ranges, their distribution throughout these ecoregions. We looked at species with less than 100 of those 50 by 50 kilometer grid cells, and we counted them up. Found that there are a lot in the northern Andes ecoregions up in here. There are a lot in the Atlantic rainforests. There are many in other places, but that's where the highest numbers are, in Central America. So that's where the species with small ranges are. These are all species that were not included in our model. The other thing we wanted to look at is fairly simple assessment of how climate might change. We know how hydrology might change. So we know a lot of these amphibians are susceptible to changes in their habitats. And so simple changes in hydrology may have large effects on amphibian populations. So basically, we want to know where is it going to get hotter and drier, because that's potentially likely to have the largest negative effect on amphibian habitats. Well, we know it's going to get hotter everywhere. Some areas hotter than others. But we know it's going to get hotter everywhere. Where is it going to get drier? These are projections of where precipitation is going to change in 4 different seasons for the next 100 years. And we summarized those 10 GCMs we were working with for the different emission scenarios. And these are areas, the dark red and the dark blue, are areas where there was more agreement across the models in terms of how much change we were like, or what direction the precipitation change would be. So 8 to 10 of the models predicted drier in the dark red areas. 8 to 10 of the models, or 80 to 100% of the models, predicted wetter in the dark blue areas. So then what we did is we looked and we summarized that. We looked at where in any one given season, in any season period, are we likely to see consistent drying in the Western Hemisphere in the next 100 years. And so these are the maps we get. This is for the B1 scenario, the lower and the higher CO2 emission scenario. We see that we're projected to see consistent drying, basically in Mexico, Central America, the Caatinga, parts of the extreme western portion of South America. And then if we look at the higher scenario, that's sort of amplified and moved up into North America a little more. But what if we put all these things together? So here's species turnover, the map we had. Here's small ranges, the species with small ranges, and here's the hotter and drier areas. If we look at this alone, we miss a number of things. First of all, we miss the fact that there are a lot of sensitive species in the Atlantic rainforest. There are a lot of small range species in the Atlantic rainforest. And then we probably underestimate what's going on in the northern Andes and in Central America, where in addition to those changes that our models predict, there are lots and lots of small range species that weren't even included in our models. And then there are certain areas, like the Caatinga, where our models didn't project big range shifts or lots of species moving around. There weren't many species with small ranges compared to other areas, but that area is projected to consistently get drier, which means it may have negative effects on amphibian habitats. So we can put all those things together, and we did this by picking certain cutoffs for each of those different maps, and we can look at the areas that are likely to see, for example, 3 of those elements, the small range species, the turnover, and the drying happening. And we can look at those as potentially being areas that are likely to be the most vulnerable in terms of for amphibians. Okay, and so this is just to conclude. First of all, we know that even low CO2 emission scenarios, as the B1, are likely to have big effects on amphibians, likely to cause fairly large changes in amphibian communities in any one given place. We noted that even the most optimistic dispersal scenarios, amphibians are likely to see fairly major range contractions across the as a taxon. And finally, that it's necessary to look beyond these range shift projections for other ways that species might be susceptible